about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. The Engineering Committee will meet on the first Wednesday at 7 p.m.
Do what you did yesterday, go on repeat it, 'cause my heart is only on fire, you are the teacher.
Welcome to Between the Covers, a weekly KBOO program all about books and the people who write them. I'm your host this week, Ken Jones. On today's show, our guest is Panio Giannopoulos, author of the story collection, How to Get Into Our House and Where We Keep the Money. Panio's stories, essays, and poetry have appeared in Tin House, Northwest Review, Salon, Chicago Quarterly Review, Big Fiction, The Brooklyn Rail, and the Los Angeles Review of Books. He's also the author of a novella, A Familiar Beast, which was an Amazon Best Book of the Month. Panio is a recipient of a New York Foundation for the Arts Award for Nonfiction and has contributed to the anthologies The Bastard on the Couch, The Encyclopedia of X's, and Cooking and Stealing, The Tin House Nonfiction Reader. Kirkus Reviews writes of How to Get Into Our House and Where We Keep the Money, a wonderful collection of 9 stories combining wry humor, engaging characters, and shrewd psychological insight. Witty, discerning, and laugh-out-loud funny. Panio Giannopoulos, welcome to KBOO.
Thanks for having me.
Now, I got to explain, we're recording today, and you flew out from New York.
Yeah.
So there was quite a story of how you got out here. Your flight yesterday was canceled.
Right. So it was the big bomb cyclone, whatever it's been called.
Right.
First, everything got postponed, then it got delayed, and then canceled. And so I left the house at 4:45 in the morning, got to the airport, and then we sat on the airplane and waited for an hour and a half, and then they de-iced the wings. I don't know if you've ever experienced that. I never have.
No,
so what happens
scary,
is, it's scary. First of all, you just don't want ice anywhere near your wings, apparently. So they de-ice it, and it's like going through a car wash. I open the little, you know, the little window shutter, whatever you call that.
Oh, right.
Yeah. So I could see it, and there's a huge blast of dark brown liquid, almost like bloodish red. It's like being at the worst car wash you've ever been. And it just slapped against the window, and I sort of jerked back and immediately made an enemy out of my seatmate, who just looked at me with, you know, this is 6 in the morning.
And this is on the runway at LaGuardia.
On the runway at LaGuardia. And so eventually we left, but we landed 7 minutes after my connecting flight took off. So then I rushed to go rent a car to drive down from Seattle. On the way to rent the car, I lost my wallet. So had to find that. That took a little while. Eventually got the car, drove down, and then made it. But it's like sort of an odyssey, but with very low stakes.
And you did a Powell's reading right before this.
Right before this.
It was initially scheduled for last night.
Yeah, for last night.
O'clock.
So we switched it up to an afternoon reading.
Yeah. In conversation with Daniel Wilson, who was a writer, you worked, a Portland-based author.
Yeah, Portland author.
You worked with him as an editor.
Yeah, I was his editor for the first 3 titles he worked on, about all about robots, How to Survive a Robot Uprising, and Where's My Jetpack? And they were great, very funny books with real science, because he studied at, you know, I think MIT or Carnegie Mellon, I'm not sure which. So he knows his robot stuff.
And one thing that became clear from the conversation you had with Daniel, he started out writing novels, and now he's working on short stories, which
right.
you found interesting, because
yeah, it's backwards.
Take the opposite path.
Right.
The book we're talking about is a collection of stories. And I know you're currently working on a novel. You mentioned that. Mm-hmm. You said you're about 2/3 of the way through the first draft. And you've done the novella, A Familiar Beast.
Right.
So how do you decide whether an idea is best expressed as a story, a novella,
yeah.
or a novel?
Well, the way I think about it is, a story is like a first date. That's usually the metaphor I use, where it's low commitment. You know, even if it's a terrible first date, it's probably... you get through it. It's just one night. So a story doesn't take that long to write a first draft of. A novella takes a couple weeks. It's like a vacation love affair. You go off, you meet someone, you fall in love. And then a novel is marriage. I mean, you were just in it for years and years and years. You find out things about yourself maybe you didn't know. Maybe you didn't want to know. It's so psychologically intensive. So part of it is like, what do I have the endurance for? You know, what do I want to do right now? Do I really want to commit? And then part of it is, how do I want to spend all that time, you know, part of it's daydreaming, part of it's actually writing, you know, where do I want my head to be? So sometimes I will write something experimental with a character and I'll think, okay, this is fun, this is a provocative character, but I only want to spend a week with that guy.
And that's a short story.
Yeah, that's a short story. So you just spend a week with that person. And other things that I think are more nuanced, with a greater range of emotion, I'll think, okay, then you can sort of jump from emotion to emotion. You can spend, you know, I'll spend a month working on a chapter that's about grief, and then I'll spend a month working on a chapter that's about falling in love. And so it's just a slightly different, you sort of moderate your emotions in a different way over the long term when it's a novel.
And then the novella itself was kind of a combination of the two.
Right.
A character you want to spend a little bit more time with, but maybe not several years.
Right. Actually, that started as a short story. And as I was developing, I thought, oh, there's more to it. I don't want to just wrap this up. Which gets to the maybe the bigger point, which is to some degree, the story dictates the format. You know, as you start telling it, you realize, oh, this is a bigger story. Or, oh, actually, this is just a slice. This is just a moment. And that's all that's really needed.
The book we're talking about, Ponyo, is a collection of stories, and there's 9 stories in the book. When writing these, and I know you did that over a period of time, did you have any unifying theme or structure in mind?
Really, it was when I was collecting them together to make a story collection that I thought, I sort of scrambled, frankly. I thought, oh God, I hope I have a theme, because everybody wants to, it's really just a marketing thing, right? You're like, oh, I have to, this is a story collection about this, or... And I thought, oh God, what are my themes? So as I was reviewing it, I did notice a few themes, right? So one of them is envy, in that a lot of the characters want things other characters have, which sounds very obvious. But in fact, a lot of stories I read aren't about envy. They're about, I don't know, they're just different stories. And I thought, that's kind of an interesting, slightly fresh take on relationships. And then a lot of the stories are also love stories or love triangles. And that was another part of it, was I'd like to just throw 3 characters together and then see what happens.
And some of those characters aren't even human. There's,
right, there's a love triangle.
A love triangle with a man, a woman, and a dog.
Exactly, yeah. And then there's one that's really a love triangle between, or not a love triangle, but it's this really tortured love story between a single dad and his little, really exhausting little daughter. And so you've got this guy who sort of spent his life dating and being kind of emotionally elusive, and then he falls head over heels in love for his little daughter, and he's raising her, and she is sort of like every woman he tried to get away from. But he can't escape, right? You can't not take care of your daughter. You can't not love her and raise her. So I thought, what an interesting thing where your fate kind of grows up right next to you.
And that's the beautiful story, actually, the last one in the book, I'll Be Your Fever.
Thank you.
When reading through it, I got some other main themes, at least, that recurred to me. And one is kind of the disconnect between several of the characters' romantic views on what their lives should be like. And most of them, if not all of them, are in middle age, in their 40s.
Most of them. You know, the character from Love and Heuristics is in his sort of late 20s, and the character in Murmur is, again, like pretty young 20s. But other than that, it's mostly middle-aged characters.
So they've got that kind of romantic view that I guess the younger characters, that romantic view hasn't dissipated yet in a lot of ways. And then the character in Love
and Heuristics. It's another
way to say they're jaded. Really isn't, right? That the character in Love and Heuristics isn't very romantic at all anyway.
No, that's what the whole story is about.
Right.
He's so unromantic that he creates an algorithm to teach him how to be romantic.
Yeah, that was funny. I've been in computers a long time. I worked in computers a long time, so I know people like that, programmers. And there's that romantic view, and it conflicts with the realities of their current lives, such as stress and disappointment from marriages, children, work, finances, which leads to a very deep dissatisfaction with their current situation. And I think in a lot of cases that creates the conflict in the story.
Well, you know, it's funny. There's been quite a lot of research about this. Not that I drew upon it naturally for the fiction, but where the unhappiest time in people's lives traditionally, right, or statistically, are 40s through early 50s. And then it drops. And they try and, you know, I didn't do the data analysis, but they try and make sure it's not because of children. You know, they do with both children and not children. It's not just being a parent, right? And what happens is, this is the theory, because there's a severe uptick in your mid-50s, right? The idea is that in your 40s, you really come face to face with the things you have not achieved.
Your failures.
Your failures, right. That's another way of saying it. I was trying to be nice about it, but yeah, you're in your 40s and you think, okay, well, I guess I'm not going to be an Olympic athlete, or I'm not going to do this, or I'm not going to be a millionaire, or I'm not going to invent this thing. Whatever these failures are, these huge ambitions I think most of us harbor, they're gone. And it's hard to take. It's a kind of grief. I mean, not to overstate it. I mean, obviously there's bigger grief where you lose someone, but you're in a way, you're losing this identity that you had when you were younger, this aspirational identity. And I think it's a real struggle for a lot of people. And so you face it in different ways, right? Some people run away from it. Some people, fight it. Some people drug it away. You know, some people have affairs. You know, there's all these different responses to it. And so a lot of the stories, I'm having these characters kind of looking in the mirror metaphorically and saying how did I get here? I mean, it's the Talking Heads song, which is kind of brilliant. You know, this is not my beautiful house. This is not my beautiful this life. Moment of just horrible self-awareness. And you think like, whoa, how did I get here? Now, if you can get through it and find some sort of equanimity, that's where the happiness starts. That's where you start feeling gratitude. Because probably while you didn't get these other things that you wanted, a lot of other things did happen that are pretty great. So I do like to think that these aren't stories. I mean, they're not supposed to be pessimistic stories. They're just stories of that struggle of reflection and kind of battling against, you know, really it's a lot of it battling against your ego and what you wanted to be versus what you've become.
Another theme I kind of got from it is one of redemption. There's a story in here called Runners of San Vicente.
Right.
And there's one character, his friend disappears, whether mysteriously through his own means, which is a possibility given the story, or something a little more sinister. All of a sudden, he's afraid that he might lose his wife in a similar way. She might run off or whatever.
Yeah.
And you have a paragraph there. Pani, would you read that? I think it kind of distills that theme.
Right. So this is in reaction to his fear about his wife. Without Emily, I didn't know what I would have done. The pressures and anxieties of my life often threatened to overwhelm me. Our ever-rising debt, as we consistently live beyond our means, my stalled career as a musician, the perpetual disquiet of raising children in a world designed to devour or break them, and the thought of having to face these adversities alone was unbearable.
And we see that not just in that story, but the main character in several of the stories is facing similar situation.
Mm-hmm.
Children, marriage, their work, their finances. Some of them are out of work.
Yeah.
So some of them are just kind of scraping by.
Mm-hmm.
So that leads us to that theme that I also found in here, that of redemption. The main character in each story, and we talked about kind of the suffering that they go through.
Yeah.
A lot of it due to love.
Yeah, the punishment of love, as
right.
I like to call it.
But it often, or at least several of the stories I like the most, leads to something good.
Mm-hmm.
A moment at least of love or self-acceptance. And I'm thinking of three stories in particular. There's A Venus in Fur, which is that triangle between the man, woman, and the dog. The title story, How to Get Into Our House and Where We Keep the Money. And most especially the last story in the book, I'll Be Your Fever, which we mentioned, they're all very moving endings. That last one, that was just a knockout for me.
Thank you.
You're reading it. I was kind of tearing up in a good way. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that, kind of putting your characters through the suffering, but giving them a little bit of a redemption at the end. I mean, it's not necessarily a happy ending, but there's some joy. There's something
right.
in there.
Well, that's, you know, really, that is definitely a choice I make as a writer very consciously. It's really easy to end bleakly. It's an easy way to end a story. And not to disparage it. I don't mean easy like, you know, super simple and you shouldn't do it. You should aim for complexity.
But it's fairly common.
It's fairly common because, you know, where do you stop? Like, where do you stop a story? Well, you know, the temptation is to end on something bleak because there's a certain amount of drama in that, right? We think like, oh, the sad thing. I mean, think about like every ending of Mad Men, right? Don Draper is just staring off into the distance.
He's screwed up again.
Screwed up again, Don. And I thought, okay, I don't want to, if you're going to go through all this pain, and this is maybe the optimist to me, the pain and the conflict and the embarrassment and the shame and all, you know, all the things we go through as we sort of scramble and try to make sense of our lives and our choices. I can't bear to just leave people miserable. So part of it is just my own worldview as an author is just, there is so much pain. There's so much grief. So much goes wrong. And yet, in a slightly Cheever-esque way, because I'm a big fan of John Cheever stories, there are also these moments of sort of inexplicable joy, and there's inexplicable hope. And I actually don't think it's, because I do try to write realistic fiction, I don't think it's an accurate representation just to sort of narrowly pursue the bleakness and the depression and the horrible things, and really not give the joy its sort of moment of representation too. Because those are the things that keep us going. And they can be anything. I mean, it doesn't have to be a deep connection to another person, although that's usually where it's from.
You're listening to Between the Covers on KBOO Community Radio. On today's show, we're talking with Panio Giannopoulos, author of the story collection, How to Get Into Our House and Where We Keep the Money.
I was remembering the last time I was in Portland, which was about 12 years ago, with my wife. We were on this tour she was doing, and I walked down this pathway, and it was rainy. It rained all night, and I walked down, and in the morning, there was this enormous spider web, and it was glistening. There were drops in it.
Oh, beautiful. Okay.
This is 13 years ago, as I'm just walking down a path, and I still remember how beautiful it was. I hate spiders, incidentally, so it had to be pretty. And I think, okay, that was one moment where I had this little boost of like, okay, there's something about just being alive that's pretty great.
And it was probably enhanced by the crappy day before, the rain and all that. So I think you have the skill here, the mastery, to show that this redemption, these little moments of joy at the end of the stories are very well earned. I mean, the characters have been put through a lot of bad things and suffering and pain.
Yeah.
And you just feel for them, and you kind of are hoping that something good will happen here. And again, it might not last a whole lot.
Right. It's not the happy ending, but it's something, I'm dealing with now with the novel, where I think, okay, I don't want to wrap everything up falsely. That's not fair to the character. But at the same time, if you're going to spend a few hundred pages with this family and these characters, you can't just leave feeling like, oh, what did I go through all through that for? If we're just going to end up in the same place, the same amount of unhappiness. Like, there has to be some sense of progress, even if it's just a growing self-awareness and a hope that maybe you won't make the exact same mistakes again.
Now, there are several elements in the stories that you take from your own life. In the story, The Flower of One's Heart, the main character's dad had died several years before, and he's still kind of trying to get over it. I read that your dad died about 6 years ago.
Yep.
And you mentioned also that the novel you're working on now has something to do with that also.
Mm-hmm.
Also in that story, this main character starts taking martial arts lessons and even starts teaching some classes. And I read that you're actually a third-degree black belt in Taekwondo.
Yes, that's right.
So the stories, they do have some basis in your own life. How do you weave them into the tales? Because obviously the fiction kind of takes off from there.
Right. Well, it certainly helps for verisimilitude. You know, when you write realistic fiction, if you know what the place looks like, you know what it smells like, you know what the actions are like. For martial arts, for example, I would be hard pressed to write a really persuasive short story about ice hockey. I don't really know how to play it, but martial arts, I know it, you know, inside and out. So I do try to ground stories in things that I know. For example, the dog story. I once had a very small dog. I went on vacation with it, so I had that to play with. But then I, architect these conflicts around it that I very often don't experience. For the one about the martial arts instructor, it's interesting. You know, I wrote that years before my father passed away. And I do find that sometimes stories have almost a predictive capacity to them.
Oh, that's amazing. I would have thought the opposite, that you read it in response to your...
No, father. I mean, I certainly deepened it once my father did pass away and I was dealing more with grief, but I wrote it a good 7 years before my dad died. And it's spooky sometimes when you do that as a writer. And I've talked to other writers, so it's not a phenomenon strictly to me. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm not like a, Nostradamus or anything. I mean, it could just be coincidence. You write enough stories and some of them line up. But it is a weird feeling that you'll write a story and then something similar will happen to you in real life. And two things happen. On the one hand, you compare and you say like, well, did I get it right? Are the experiences similar to what I expected? And then the other part is, now I can't write about it. I already wrote about it. I wrote about it before it even happened. So that's a wasted experience because you're always looking for, something to write
about.
Did
you revise the story then after your father died?
I did. I added...
You mentioned deepening
it? Yeah, I deepened it a lot, actually. I added a lot to it. And I questioned that because my editor at Four Way Books said, either add more of the dad stuff or just take it all out, because she felt like it was there wasn't quite enough.
Wow. I thought it was extremely important because it explained the narrator's or the main character's hostility. He wanted to take martial arts because he wanted to hurt people.
And right. Yeah. And I thought it was really, it was essential as well. And so I built it up. But it's funny because sometimes there's a thing missing in a story and you don't know what it is. And then either someone will point it out to you or you'll just stumble across it. Mm-hmm. And so making that a more significant relationship was, or a significant part of it, I think that's when the story clicked together.
You had mentioned, based on your own experiences, the Venus and Fur, which is the story, the love triangle, the man, the woman, and the dog.
Yeah.
You had told a story that, I should mention the dog is this irresistible little Pomeranian named Millicent, irresistible to everybody in the story except the man in the love triangle.
Yeah, George can't,
can't stand the little dog. You mentioned that your wife had a dog that was just as irresistible, a dog named Suki.
Suki, that's right.
And so Suki is kind of the model for Millicent here.
Yeah, so we went on vacation. This is before we had children, and so that's when you pamper your dogs and treat them like a child, and you're sort of that unbearable couple, which we were. So we had this cute little dog, and we went on vacation to this Greek island, and everybody lost their mind. I've never
which happens seen, in the story.
Yeah, they lost their mind. I mean, in America, I feel like maybe there's just a lot of cute little dogs, so people are a little more used to it. In Greece, there's just not a lot of cute little lap dogs. And we would literally, we'd sit at restaurants, and we would put the dog on a chair. I mean, just talk about like unbearable Americans. And the owner would come over and like give lamb bones to the dog, and she would nod them. Meanwhile, there were actual just wild dogs wandering around, and people would just kick the wild dogs. This little girl ran up to us, this little six-year-old Greek girl ran up to us and said, in sort of broken English, she said, "I love your dog, I love your dog." And I'm like, "Okay, okay." And she said, "I will kill my dog for your dog."
Oh my God.
And I was like, "Please don't kill your dog." Right. I started speaking Greek to her. Uh-huh. I was like, "Min skotas tos kilisu." Like, don't kill your dog. Like, this kind of, it's like she inspired, you know, like it was like religious fervor. And so I knew I had something there. I thought, I have to write about this. And there's something about being within this radius of, you know, fame and adulation and not being affected by it, which is a really, which is a, just a great setup for comedy.
Oh, and I think it's a very funny story. Maybe the funniest in the book.
Thank you. Yeah, it's the one I very often read from in groups because it does have the most sort of comedic moments.
Mm-hmm. There's a wonderful ending to it also. It's, again, one of redemption. Now, given the autobiographical basis for some of the stories, in an interview I read, you said, maybe half jokingly, that the secret of good writing is don't be yourself.
I was totally joking. No, I wasn't totally joking. I'll stand by that. So here's my theory.
Okay.
And this doesn't apply to all writers. It applies to me and I think a lot of writers. So I, in general, am conflict avoidant, right? I don't want to fight. I don't want to argue. It's changed a little as I've gotten older, but in general...
In your personal life.
In my personal life.
That's certainly just not going through stories, life.
No, right. Definitely not. And that actually limited me a lot as a writer starting out because my characters would also avoid conflict, which really leads to some boring stories. You know, it's like, oh no, here comes the boss. Wait, my guy just slinked off into the bathroom, you know? So what happens is I realized I was writing these stories, which were misses, like just things weren't going on. You wouldn't cringe. You wouldn't be like, oh no, there was no suspense. So I found I had to have my characters act in ways that I don't because they needed to propel themselves into conflict, into drama, right? So what happens is I'll have an experience, right? Like today on the airline or whatever, I'll have an experience and...
Like the de-icer maybe.
Or right, the de-icer. And I won't do anything about it. I won't act out. I won't argue. And then I'll think, okay, so what if I had a character and he insisted on being put into first class because he got canceled, right? And they said, no, it's full. And then we had this whole scene about it. Well, suddenly you have an actual scene. You've got some conflict. I would never do that. But I also would never read a story about me not doing that. But I would read a story about a guy being sort of imperious and unbearable and then seeing where that leads.
So you might put some autobiographical details in there.
Yes.
For example, your plane flight this morning.
Right.
But totally, this character has nothing to do with you.
It's, right. It's just, it's sort of...
He almost does the opposite of what you would do in that
very
situation.
Very much, yeah. It's like, don't, yeah, what would Ponyo do? And then, like, do the opposite. It's opposite day.
So it's a great guiding principle for authors who are conflict avoiding.
Well, in general, I think authors are witnesses, right? We're watchers.
Observers, yeah.
Yeah, we observe, exactly. We look, we think things through. We're really not impulsive. And so part of actually rendering things in interesting ways is having characters maybe who are more impulsive, who don't just, you know, really think things through and do the smart strategic thing. You want to do the mistakes. Mistakes make for fun.
You had mentioned you were a fan of Cheever.
Yes.
Earlier, and his mm-hmm. stories, of course. In doing the research, I also saw you're a big fan of Philip Roth.
Yep.
Roth, and I'm doing air quotes here, retired from writing.
Right, right.
It's hard to believe that that's the case. That was about 5 years ago. You yeah. wrote an essay at that time in his honor called Philip Roth, A Eulogy for a Living Man.
Yeah.
And in it, you describe Roth, and I'm going to quote from it, a masterfully eloquent novelist who believed, nonetheless, that writing was not about fluency, and here we go again, but mm-hmm. about conflict. And you quote him as saying, you're looking as you begin for what's going to resist you, you're looking for trouble. And I wonder how you apply that to your work.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I still, that was a very much a guiding principle as I was writing, mm-hmm. was find, it's a little bit, okay, it reminds me of meditation, which I don't do much of. And the reason I don't do much of meditation isn't because I'm lazy, although I am. But the main reason is when I actually do meditate, it's very challenging, right? When you start getting in there and moving beyond breathing and really starting to look at your thoughts and your behaviors and your, you know, you start to open yourself up to scrutiny. It's sometimes unpleasant, right? Mm-hmm. It's not just all kittens in there.
Right.
And it's a struggle and it's intense and you have to be willing to do the work. And very often I can't, I don't want to do it. Writing is the same way. I don't want to read something that just skates along the surface mm-hmm. and I don't want to write something that doesn't get into the thornier sort of more incriminating things. I guess that's the word I'm thinking of.
But it's not pleasant to do that.
It's not. And in part of the art, right, the craft of writing is like, how do you dive into the incrimination and the scary stuff and the humiliating stuff, the insecurities, the vulnerabilities that make us all human and which we connect with, frankly, and do that in a way where it's not just unbearable, right? You don't want to just make people feel bad. You don't want to just expose everything without keeping it entertaining in some way. And I don't mean that to sound like a total sellout, which I realize I do. I just mean, you know, when you read, when you tell a story, ultimately, you have to want to go along. It's not homework, right? No uh-huh. one's making you do it. No one's making you read the novel. No one's making you read the story. There has to be something fundamentally compelling about it.
But it's not just entertainment. You wrote an essay called Why Do I Write?
Yeah.
And if I could read from that, Panio, I think it shows that it's not just entertainment for you. It's an attempt to get at a deeper truth.
Sure.
And I'm quoting you from the essay. Anything I've ever written that I've been proud of, anything more than a bit of wordplay or prettiness, anything that's worthwhile, that resonates deeply with a reader, this demands an emotional involvement. It requires rousing ourselves from the curated sleepwalk that's modern life and stepping into pain, discomfort, sadness, and fear. This happiness, too, of course, is excitement and passion and intrigue, flirtation and nostalgia, curiosity and discovery. But pain and its unforgiving friends are right there at the center of it all. And it's tempting, unbelievably tempting, to avoid that pain. Mm-hmm. So you're tempted, but you know right. that doesn't make for a very honest
It doesn't. Honesty, it's, you know, what fiction is the lie that tells the truth, I guess
right.
the quote. And it's got to get to the truth. It has to. You know, not that there's only one truth, but the truth of the character, the truth of the situation.
And I think that's very clear in the book, in the stories in the book. Entertaining and honest and very moving.
Thanks.
Panio, thanks again very much for all the ordeal you went through, the travel ordeal from New York today. Flight canceled yesterday, arriving around 3 o'clock today, doing your reading at Powell's and then joining us at KBOO today. And now you're on your way to Tacoma, right, for a reading tomorrow.
That's right.
Driving up.
Yep.
Long day. I hope you sleep well tonight. But again, thanks for coming into KBOO and talking with us at Between the Covers.
Thanks for having me.
We've been talking with Panio Giannopoulos, author of the story collection, How to Get Into Our House and Where We Keep the Money. I'm Ken Jones, and this has been Between the Covers on KBOO Community Radio. Many thanks to Panio for visiting us at KBOO and to all of you for listening.
You be my master, I'll be your fever. You be my master.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Tanya Stevens in Concert on Saturday, March 31st from 9 p.m. to 2:30 a.m. at the Tao Event Center in Portland. Tanya Stevens is an influential reggae artist who began releasing records in 1994. Opening the show will be Cat and Roots Revolution plus DJ Margo Hartenfeld. There will also be food and other refreshments. Again, that's Tanya Stevens in concert on Saturday, March 31st from 9 p.m. to 2:30 a.m. at the Tau Event Center, 631 Northeast Grand Avenue in Portland. This is an 18 and over show. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
As life is much too quick for your hurry, and there's too many problems, so tell me.
The tattoo ink never runs dry. Remember when people were content to be unambitious, to sleep till 11, and just hang out with their friends? I mean, they had no occupations whatsoever, maybe working a couple hours a week at a coffee shop.
Right, I thought that died out a long time ago.
Not in Portland. Portland is a city where young people go to retire.
Dream of the 90s is alive, Portland. All the hot girls wear glasses,
yeah. Remember in the 90s when they encouraged you to be weird? It was just an amazing time where people would go to see something like the Jim Rose Sideshow Circus and watch someone hang something from their penis. You could grow up to want to be a clown. Like, people went to clown school.
I gave up clowning years ago.
Well, in Portland, you don't have to.
Dream of the 90s is alive, Portland.
Sleep till 11.
You'll be in heaven.
The dream of the 90s is alive in Portland.
Welcome to the film show on KBOO. I'm SW Concert, and today I'm joined live in the studio by three of the guiding talents behind the hit TV show Portlandia. David Kress and Kevin Sullivan are the co-producers, and Janet Weiss is the permit manager. David, Kevin, Janet, welcome to the show.
Hello.
Thanks for having us on.
We will be asking you all about the eighth and final season of Portlandia in just a few minutes. But first, I'm hoping to be joined on the line from New York by Mahalia Cohen. Mahalia is the director of the new indie film, The Last Hot Lick. Mahalia, are we with you on the phone here, I hope?